You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, money won last night. And yesterday afternoon as well. In California, it won. And in Florida, it won. I'll tell you all about that in just a moment. Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And here's the very simple thing. Mitt Romney, let me set this up in a different way. Yesterday, I was reading a letter from Thomas Jefferson. Right? This is what I do for fun. I mean, you know, some people go out in the yard and play with a dog. I read Jefferson's letters, and I'm not kidding. And although, you know, if I had a dog, we had a dog almost my whole entire life. I love going out in the yard to play with the dog, but you know, reading Jefferson's letters, there's just nothing quite like it. And this was in 1787. The United States was operating under the Articles of Confederation. So we were the United States, but we weren't really the United States yet. That wasn't until 1789 when the Constitution was ratified. So this was while the Constitution was being written. And the country was in kind of shaky shape. I mean, there was a question about whether these 13 independent nations, because the states really functioned as independent nations under the Articles of Confederation, could pull themselves together into one union, one nation. So there was a bit of a crisis. And Jefferson got this letter from an old friend of his, Edward Carrington. Jefferson was in France. He was the U.S. envoy to France at the time. He got this letter from Edward Carrington asking about, you know, this crisis that America was experiencing. Are we going to make it through? And Jefferson says, you know, the tumults in America, I expect, would have produced in Europe an unfavorable opinion of our political state, but it is not. On the contrary, the small effects of these tumults seems to have given more confidence in the firmness of our governments. In other words, we're going to make it through. Don't worry. He says the interposition of the people themselves on the side of government, in other words, participating in government, people getting involved, has had a great effect on the opinion here. Now, here is France. He's saying the Europeans are noticing that the Americans are getting involved in their own political stuff. He said, I am persuaded myself that the good sense of the people will always be the best army. They may be led astray for a moment, but will always soon correct themselves. The people are the only censors of their governors. And even their efforts will tend to keep these to the two true principles of the institution. In other words, as long as the people are aware of what's going on, as long as the people know what's going on, then this democratic republic that he helped birth with by writing the Declaration of Independence can not only can survive, will survive and prosper. But how do we do that? So Jefferson says the way to prevent these irregular interpositions of the people, in other words, the way to prevent us losing our way, is to give the people full information of their affairs through the channels of the public papers and contrive that those papers should penetrate the whole mass of the people. This is why they subsidize. This is why to this day, from Jefferson's time until today, fourth-class mail, newspapers in the mail, are subsidized. It's why during Jefferson's time, they subsidized the cost of paper to print newspapers. It would be the equivalent of today subsidizing, saying, you know, we're going to do everything we can to make sure that everybody in the country has free high-speed or inexpensive high-speed internet service. Because that's the papers of today. Or that the big media monopolies, you know, a few giant networks owning literally, I mean, like five companies owning well over 200 of the channels available on cable, that, you know, we're going to break them up. Let's have some diversity here. He says, the basis of our governments being the opinion of the people, the very first object should be to keep that right. And this is the famous quote from his where he talks about newspapers and government. He says, and if we're left to decide whether, to me to decide whether we should have a government without newspapers or newspapers without a government, I should not hesitate for a moment to prefer the latter. But I should mean that every man should receive these newspapers and be capable of reading them. This is why he wanted universal public education. It's why he started the University of Virginia as a free college. Then it gets really interesting, because he's going to get to the rich here, which brings us to Mitt Romney in just a second. He said, I am convinced that those societies as the Indians, which live without government, enjoy in their general mass an infinitely greater degree of happiness than those of us who live under the European governments. He says, among the former, the Indians, public opinion is the place of law and restrains morals as powerfully as laws did anywhere. Among the latter, among the European governments, under pretense of governing, they have divided their nations into two classes, wolves and sheep. I do not exaggerate. This is the true picture of Europe. Cherish, therefore, Jefferson wrote, the spirit of our people and keep alive their attention. For if once they become inattentive to the public affairs, Congress, judges, and governors shall be all become wolves. And experience declares that man is the only animal which devours his own kind. For I can apply no milder term to the governments of Europe and to the general prey of the rich on the poor. Clip number three, Jacob. Mr. Romney.
I'm not concerned about the very poor. We have a safety net there. If it needs a repair, I'll fix it.
Right. Yeah, the Ryan plan. Let's turn Medicare into a voucher program. That works. You get this? I mean, you know, Thomas Jefferson is rolling over in his grave. Right now, what we have is election outcomes that are purely the function of money. Yesterday in California, you had four Democratic members of Congress who could have voted to have single-payer health care up and down the state of California. It would have been one of the first states to do it. Well, actually, the second behind Vermont. But who knows? I mean, they might have been able to implement it earlier. And four Democrats State Senator Alex Padilla, State Senator Juan Vargas, State Senator Michael Rubio, State Senator Rob Wright, all wimped out and said, no, we're not going to vote on this thing. In our morning meeting this morning, setting up the show, Sam, one of the people who works on our show, was tracking down the, you know, who funds these people. All of these guys are taking money from the health insurance industry or the medical care industry. Or it's like money won in Florida, in California yesterday. Money won in Florida yesterday. You know, Mitt Romney outspent Newt Gingrich 2-1 in South Carolina and still lost. So he didn't hedge any bets in Florida. He outspent him at least 5-1. And his PACs, he ran 13,000 ads, and Newt Gingrich ran 200. And why isn't this being talked about in the media? Why isn't it that every time this massive, and I'm no Newt Gingrich fan, I'm just saying, the guy with the most money, and by the way, not just the most money. I mean, look at where this money came from. 200 donors to Mitt Romney's super PAC brought in $30 million. Now, just 200 donors brought $30 million into his super PAC. That super PAC spent $15 million in the Florida primary with 13,000 ads. John McCain, in his entire 2008 primary, from beginning to end in every state in the union, spent only $11 million. Mitt Romney just spent $15 million in Florida to eke out a little bit of a margin here. And by the way, Barack Obama's super PAC, $6 million so far. That's all he's got. Mitt Romney, $30 million from just 200 people? Yeah.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
As Jefferson said, experience declares the man is the only animal which devours its own kind. For I can apply no milder term to the general prey of the rich on the poor. Okay, so in the midst of this, here we have, on the one hand, you've got Mitt Romney, who has, you know, some of the hit parade of Mitt Romney quotes. I'm not concerned with the very poor. Banks aren't bad people. Corporations are people, my friend. I like being able to fire people who provide services to me. I'm also unemployed. There were a couple of times I wondered whether I was going to get a pink slip. $374,000 isn't not very much. I'll tell you what, $10,000, you want to bet? I'm not looking to put money in people's face. Yeah, quote from quotes classic, the hit parade. As I pointed out, 4 years ago, John McCain spent $11 million on the entire primary and won it. On a whole year's worth of advertising, Mitt Romney just spent $15 million in one state to run 13,000 ads against Newt Gingrich, who ran 200 ads. And Newt still almost ate his lunch. You know, what does this say about the Republican field? You can play sportscaster on that one all day long. I'm more concerned with what it says about our democracy. In the meantime, we've got people out there saying who are brave patriots, American genuine patriots, who are standing up and saying, wait a minute, inequality has gone too far. It's not right to have something and call it a democracy or call it a republic when a guy worth a couple hundred million dollars like Mitt Romney can go to 200 hedge fund managers and billionaires, get $30 million and buy a state with it. That's not right. Mitt Romney's a creature of Wall Street. He made his money on Wall Street, and he's going to Wall Street for his money. And so Occupy Wall Street says, no, this isn't the way to run a democracy or a republic or whatever you want to call it. It's no way to run a country. The people should have a say, not just the rich. And so you've got people here in D.C., McPherson Square. You've got people occupying the square, and just to make a statement, equality matters. And here's how the police reacted to one of them day before yesterday.
Why are you coming at me? Please. Get away from me. I have done nothing wrong. I have done nothing wrong.
That's a taser. That's shooting him with a taser and then repeatedly shocking him. Because it's the kind that's got the wire going into him. And how does, now you would think conservatives, those of you who've watched or listened for a long time know that, by the time I was 16 years old, I was out in the streets protesting the Vietnam War with SDS. When I was 13, I went door to door with my dad for Barry Goldwater in the election of 64. And I remember what real conservatives used to think. And real conservatives used to be very worried about a government that would taser citizens for exercising free speech. Real conservatives used to have a love of this country and a love for the people in this country. Real conservatives, like Barry Goldwater even, used to have respect for people who protested the status quo when they thought the status quo was unfair and unjust. In fact, Barry Goldwater considered himself one of those people who was protesting. But modern-day conservatives, they just suck up to the big corporations. They just try to divide Americans from one another, and they do it like this.
Believe it or not, these people are still occupying places. McPherson Square in Washington, D.C., near the White House. An Occupy D.C. protester was shocked by stun gun yesterday afternoon at McPherson Square. He was charged with disturbing the police. Now, I would play the video for you because it was caught on film. It's hilarious. I won't play it on the radio because of the number of F-bombs the guy just starts yelling as they're tasing him. But watching a hippie protester get tased just makes my day. It is just made of awesome.
Yeah, so that's one of the more pathetic right wing talk show guys. And you get what's, it's like, what has this country devolved to that a multimillionaire, a multi-hundred millionaire can go to billionaires and get enough money to buy an election in a state, and it's treated like a horse race in the media, and there's virtually no mention of the fact that he basically bought the election, or the fact that elections are viable in the United States. The 13,000 ads versus 200 ads produces, well, still not 50% of the vote, but, you know, produces a win. We have to find our moral compass again. We have to return to the foundational values of this country. And we have to say to the nine guys, men and women in black robes just down the street from me here in Washington, D.C., who consider themselves the kings of America, no thank you. Corporations are not people, and money is not speech. Money is property. And corporations are legal fictions created by the state and answerable to we the people because we are the state. We need to amend the Constitution to eliminate this legal fiction, and we need to do away with these obscene tax rates. Mitt Romney paying 13.9% on his taxes last year on tens of millions of dollars in income. There is something fundamentally wrong. Warren Buffett has some thoughts on that. I'll share with you after the break, and then we'll pick up some of your calls on this topic and others of the day right after this. It's 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Harbin here with you. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Corporate interests backing Romney to buy the state. That's not a democracy. That's a sale. That's a fire sale. Slightly unbalanced, the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome back. By the way, that conservative I played the clip from earlier, that was Eric Erickson, just to give credit where credit is due. The talk show host. Ronald Reagan thought it was wrong that people like Mitt Romney and the hedge fund billionaires on Wall Street who are funding his campaign should pay a maximum, or should pay a lower tax rate, let's say, than the rest of us. So he set them. He actually, in 86... Ronald Reagan actually set the tax rates for people like Mitt Romney, the capitalist gains tax, set that as being identical with the ordinary income tax, both of them at 28%. Now the capitalist gain tax is 15%, and the ordinary income tax has gone up to 36%. But Reagan set them both at 28%, and here's what he said when he did it.
We're going to close the unproductive tax loopholes that have allowed some of the truly wealthy to avoid paying their fair share. They sometimes made it possible for millionaires to pay nothing while a bus driver was paying 10% of his salary, and that's crazy.
And that's crazy, okay? And here's Warren Buffett, this is clip number 10, referencing that and talking about, hey, capital gains rates, the taxes that Warren Buffett pays, you know, why don't you raise the taxes?
Capital gains rates have been much higher in the past. They were at the same rate as Reagan signed a bill where he made them the same rate as ordinary income when it was 28%. And capital formation in this country in the 50s and 60s and 70s with much higher rate was just fine. And still fine today, incidentally.
Capital formation was just fine. In other words, there was no shortage of rich people to put money into businesses. Then, regardless of the tax rate, then, now, you know, fill it in. Walter in Leesburg, Virginia. Hey, Walter, what's on your mind today?
Hey, I want to talk about what Romney said, that he doesn't really care about the poor. It's he's not really that concerned. Everyone needs to watch Mrs. Scrooge with Susan Lucci. And the reason I'm saying that is because she said that, too. She says, oh, aren't there homeless shelters? Those people can go there.
Right.
That's what he, in a sense, that's what he's saying, that
yeah,
I'm not concerned
there's,
with the
there's
poor.
A social safety net. I'm not worried about that. Well, really what he was saying, in my opinion, was that he's not concerned about the very poor because they don't vote. And this is what Acorn was trying to do, was to mobilize very poor people to get them to vote, and that's why the Republicans took it down with lies. But that's essentially what was being said. Excellent point, Walter. Thank you. Mark in Northville, Michigan. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Hey, hi there, Tom. Great show. Love that Reagan clip. You know, this reminded me, this election financing, reminded me of the election back in 1972 when Dick Nixon ran against McGovern. Nixon's reelection that year spent $1 million. It was a cover story on Time magazine, it was considered a travesty.
Right, the first million-dollar election. Mind-boggling amounts of money.
Dick Nixon.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And now we're spending $15 million to win one state primary. Yeah. It boggles my mind.
Yeah, it boggles my mind, too. And just to put it in contrast, you know, Mitt Romney just spent, and thanks a lot for the call, Mark, Mitt Romney just spent $15 million to run 13,000 ads in, well, not him. He spent $15 million, his PACs. You know, we have no idea yet what they've spent, but they ran 13,000 ads. It might have been that they spent 30, 40, 50 million. Who knows how much they spent in Florida? They bought a hell of a lot of television. 13,000 ads? Those ads do not cost a dollar a piece. I guarantee you that. So, or even $10 a piece. So anyhow, 13,000. Mitt and Gingrich had 200 ads, and he nearly beat Romney. Interesting. Daryl in Buffalo. Hey, Daryl.
Yeah.
You're on the air. What's up?
What's up? I wanted to say two things. You were talking about earlier some of the, I believe, the Jeffersonian experience.
Yeah.
Okay. Give the Iroquois Nation, which lasted 1,000 years or thereabouts, give them credit for acknowledging each and every citizen and his concerns.
Yeah, I do, and Jefferson did as well.
I've listened to you for a long, long time, and I appreciate it. The second point is, when we get off this papacy run, the King of Kings, the one magical creature that came back from the grave, get off the King of Kings, get off the European notion of, and who is the King of Kings emissary, the Pope. Get off the papacy.
Yeah. It's not just the Pope. It's virtually every religion that is evangelical out there, Daryl, and they're all running around saying, I've got the only answer. This is the only true answer. And by the way, the evangelical religions, by the way, you've got to do it my way or you're screwed. And, you know, I don't have a problem with people saying, I think I have the answer for me. But, you know, don't knock on my door. Don't knock on my door. And don't knock on my door to tell me not to have an opinion. Hans in Vashon, Washington. Hey, Hans, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Hey, do you remember that figure that's been floated around so many times of what percentage of wealth is actually inherited? It's over 50%, I know.
I don't. That would be a good number to have at my fingertips. And Hans, I'm not sure how you say it. Hans?
No problem.
I don't know.
But Orwellian.
If you can find that out or you can track it down, you know, drop into our chat room and put a link for it, and I'll pull it out and I'll use it. But I don't have it right offhand. But thank you for the call. Jim in Los Angeles. Hey, Jim, what's up? Thanks for listening to K-Talk.
Hi, Tom. Good morning. How are you?
Great. What's up?
I heard what you said about the money and election, and I agree with you 100%. I'm a conservative, and I support Gingrich. And you can see that experiment where he started positive in Iowa, as he said, and didn't run any campaigns. And then Romney started with this campaign. He got killed in Iowa. He fought back. He won. So it seems like, unfortunately, that this is the reality of the elections. And I think whoever becomes the nominee is going to face the same type of battle with Obama. So if everybody agrees to let go of this, money and ads, I think we'll have a better Democratic election. But I don't think everybody is going to play by this game.
No, they're not. Because they can't. They can't afford to. What's happened is that we're not voting for people anymore. We're voting for special interest groups. The special interest groups who are propping up human beings in front of them, the corporations and Wall Street banksters and giant banks, they're propping up human beings like Mitt Romney or Newt Gingrich or Barack Obama. I fill in the blanks. Increasingly, and this is the tragedy of it, because frankly, I think that there are a lot of politicians. I doubt Mitt Romney is one of them. But I think that there are a lot of politicians, both on the left and the right, who would love to be free of the shackles of this. I was in an office building yesterday with Louise, and I stepped into an elevator in an office building here in Washington, D.C., and a guy walks into the one other guy steps into the elevator with us, and it was a United States senator who we immediately recognized. And I'm not going to out him here, but, you know, he was obviously going to it was one of the office buildings where senators have offices where they just call, they dial for dollars a couple hours every day. And it's like, it's a tragedy that people should have to do that. I don't care if they're Republicans or Democrats. It's a tragedy that they should have to do that. And it's a crime that we have a political system. Thanks for the call, Jim. Here in the United States, brought to you courtesy of our Supreme Court that creates more and more of that. I mean, it's just a crime. Chip in Tampa, Florida. Hey, Chip, thanks for listening to WMNS. What's up?
Sure. Hi, Tom. I'm coming from you with the conclusion or the assumption that Romney is going to be the nominee.
I think that's a safe assumption. He's got the money.
Well, I was going to say, because if for no other reason, the big money is behind Romney, and these days in politics, what the big money wants, the big money gets.
Yeah.
And I think that three of the biggest, most critical problems that this country is facing right now is the concentration of wealth, the amount of corporate power there is, or the power of the corporations, and the amount of money that we spend on our military. And when you look at Mitt Romney, you've got a guy who's a member of that exclusive 0.1% wealthiest.
Right.
He believes very much that corporations are people, my friend.
Right.
And he's all about growing the military. And if there's three things that we don't need in the White House more, it's someone who is pro on all those three issues.
Yeah. I would submit to you that your one and two are the largest frame and the real core problem, and that your number three, growing the military, you know, I could add a whole bunch of other things to that as well. And, we've got serious problems. We don't have a decent health care system in this country. We're being bled dry by bankers who call themselves health insurance companies. We don't have a decent education system in this country anymore. We've slipped to like 17th in the world in the higher education. We've got kids graduating, so badly in debt that they'll be 45 years old before they paid off their college debts. You've got, and the president of the United States paid off his college loans, a year before he became president. I mean, we've got some serious, but they all come from that first original sin, which is saying that money is speech and that corporations are people, and that you can use the corporate form to amass unlimited amounts of money, and then you can call that speech and you can use it for the second thing that you pointed out, which is in the political arena. And that should be, that's the original crime from which, whether it's pollution, whether it's XL Keystone Pipeline, whether it's, I mean, fill in the blank, and or half the bugaboos on the right, they come out of that. And
well,
so
I agree with you. And the reason that I included number three, spending on the military, is because if there's one fundamental basic truth in economics, it's the idea of opportunity cost.
Yep.
You can spend your money here or there. You can spend it one time only, and you have to make choices and decisions.
That's right. But
and,
see, if
all the billions that go into defense are billions that aren't going into health care and education.
Which is absolutely right, which is the cross of iron speech that Dwight Eisenhower gave in 1954 to the Society newspaper editors. Absolutely right. But again, that wouldn't happen if there weren't lobbyists here in Washington, D.C. for the military-industrial complex, those people that Eisenhower warned us about. Thanks, Chip, for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
45 minutes past the hour. If once they become attentive to the public affairs, Congress, judges, and governors shall all become wolves.
It's not for the money, not the fame. They want the power, the rush, and the game.
Rich man's world.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Joseph in Beckley, West Virginia. Hey, Joseph, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, I want to tell you that I love your show. I've been sitting here waiting to give my comment, and it's been crazy because as I've been listening, I've been hearing so many things that I agree upon and want to comment on, but let me just comment on my comment.
Okay.
And just tell you that you're doing a great job. It's
Thank you.
Awesome, completely. Well, last night I was watching your show, The Big Picture,
mm-hmm.
And you had made a comment that you were talking about overpopulation, and you were saying women need to be educated in order to regulate overpopulation.
Educated and empowered, yes.
Exactly, and that's exactly the point that I want to make right now, because I believe that women in America need to be educated and empowered, because we rate like lower than Iraq, I believe, in women in power. And it's this concept. It's not just electing them. It's will they be able to even have the power to make the changes in this male-centered society?
Yeah, I agree. In Iraq, by the way, the reason that you have more women in the parliament is because they actually wrote into their constitution that there's a certain threshold. I think it's 30%. It's 40% in Norway. It's written into their constitution. So there's a mandate that you know, so when they're picking primary candidates and things like that or whatever to run for a particular, it wouldn't be congressional, it would be parliamentary position. If there's a shortage of women, it's going to be only women running, which is fine with me. I see that as the equivalent of an affirmative action program that brings you back up to where you should be because, you know, the population, our population distribution is 51-49, women to men. In the world, women tend to live a little longer than men, and it's crazy that the power distribution is probably 95-5 or something like that, and in the United States you've got very few women in power in the Congress, you've got very few women senators, we've never had a woman president. In the corporate boardrooms, women are the rarity; they're the exception rather than the rule, and that is even in the United States after, 30 years of a women's rights movement that's been fairly aggressive. Compare that to countries where women are literally, from birth, the property of their families, and then they're sold to their husbands' families, and they're basically the property of their husbands. Now, which is, by the way, how it was in the United States at one time, way, way back. Not entirely, but largely. Women had no rights until the mid-19th century. They couldn't own property. They couldn't, if their husband died, and a male executor was assigned to them. It was pretty bizarre. It was pretty amazing, actually. It's amazing how far we've come. But I'm with you. We need to, and if we empower women, that's the one thing that you see that will cause population growth to slow down faster than anything else. Joseph, well said. Thank you very much. I appreciate it for the call. Robert in Pico Rivera, California. Hey, Robert, what's on your mind?
How you doing, Tom? I just wanted to quote from Jefferson. It goes like, if the American people ever allow banks to issue their currency, first by inflation, then by deflation, the banks and the corporations which will grow up around them will deprive the people of all property until their children wake homeless on the continent their fathers conquered.
Yes. Yes, well said.
In my opinion, the root cause of all evil is the banking itself that lends money at interest to our government and to people. And unless we correct this, unless we fix this, all the other problems that we're talking about, in my opinion, will never be.
I agree. This is a serious problem, but again, if we got money out of politics, then the Fed, which actually, the banks that own the Fed are very profitable institutions. They can lobby on behalf of the Fed. There are very few members of Congress. You've got basically Ron Paul, Dennis Kucinich, and Bernie Sanders who are willing to take on the Fed, and I believe maybe Sherrod Brown and a few others. But it's a very small minority. And if you got money out of politics, you could have people take on the Fed. And I agree with you. The Fed needs to be nationalized. We need to be issuing our own currency like the Constitution says. Thank you very much, Robert. Vera in San Diego. Hey, Vera, what's up?
My concern, I'm a first-time caller, and I appreciate your show. And the concern I want to raise is the differentiation in treatment between the Tea Party and the Occupy Wall Street group. The Tea Partiers, they can show up with the guns and maybe just a few of them show up and they get, very expensive TV coverage. And these people are actually talking, statements they're making could be considered technically even treasonous, and yet, they get influenced, they almost are looked upon as heroes who are Occupy for criticizing the government. Occupy Wall Street is not criticizing the government. They're criticizing the corporations and the amount of inequity that's in terms of social justice and economic justice brought about by the corporate influence. And yet these are the people who are, first of all, the regular media tries not to even cover them, tries to basically ignore them. And when they do cover them, it's from a most negative point of view. And then they are brutally oppressed. and their right, constitutional right to free assembly is assaulted.
Yeah, so Vera, I'm absolutely with you, and I would love to see some more equality in the media between those two. Let me get one more caller in here before the break. Vera, thank you so much for the call. Paul in Foster, Kentucky. Quick one, Paul.
Yes, Tom. Yeah. I have one question.
Yeah.
Do the senators, the politicians that are running for president right now, do they still receive their senatorial salaries?
Yes.
That's double dipping, isn't it?
Well, no, they're not being paid by their campaigns, although they're not doing our work when they're out there campaigning. But you can't get around that. You got to figure out a way that people can run for office. And again, this is I would actually have no problem with paying a congressperson or senator's salary if they're running for office, if the way that they're running for office is coming out and knocking on doors and visiting the people and holding town hall meetings. What concerns me is when they're running for office and the way they do it is they call up their super PAC or they have a friend call up their super PAC and say, hey, carpet bomb Florida with $15 million, please. You can get it from John Paulson, the billionaire up in New York. And that's a much more, I think, horrible problem, Paul. Thanks a lot for the call. Thank you, Vera.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
So, is a libertarian a conservative or a liberal? You know, they want to decriminalize pot and heroin and prostitution, which is the kind of stuff that you see in, like, very liberal countries like Holland. But they also figure, unlike Holland, which has a national health care system, if you get sick, you're on your own. You should have saved up enough money to buy health insurance from one of those banksters at United Healthcare or something like that, if I understand this right. Matt Welch is the editor-in-chief of Reason Magazine, the co-author with Nick Lesby of the Declaration of Independence, How Libertarian Politics Can Fix What's Wrong with America, and McCain, the Myth of a Maverick. Matt, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me back, Tom.
Glad to have you with us. Are libertarians conservatives? Because I know that, or for that matter, Republicans, because I know there's a lot of Republicans and a lot of conservatives who are looking at the very, very large number, the growing number of young people who self-identify as libertarians and saying, hey, those people are part of our party.
Yeah, well, unless you listen to William Kristol, and he says those people need to go as far away from our party as possible. To answer your question, libertarians are not conservatives. Conservatives classically want to maintain or reach back to some prior status quo, and they tend to be hostile towards change. Libertarians are more optimistic by nature, and they like this sort of constant dynamic change that comes in a capitalist society. So they tend to be much more willing for radical solutions to the status quo, whether it comes from imperial withdrawal from the world that has been going on for the last several decades, whether it's legalizing, not just decriminalizing, marijuana and some of these other things. They want that
all of these, like Portugal did. I mean, Portugal decriminalized all drugs, and it broke the back of organized crime. Their addiction rates went down. Their HIV infection rate went down. I mean, all their social indicators got better. And then the EU said, hey, wait a minute, this isn't a good idea.
And libertarians will take, like, two different major strains within it. They could be represented, if you will, with Ron Paul, who's the most famous politically right now, and Gary Johnson, who's less famous, but he's probably going to run for the Libertarian Party nomination. Gary Johnson makes the cost-benefit analysis, kind of like what you just did with Portugal. Like, hey, look, it saves you money. You don't have to lock people up. We're running out of money. We need to do something. Ron Paul will make the philosophical argument that government has no business telling us what we can and can't do.
Why can't you make both arguments?
I think you can make both arguments. Libertarians try to do.
I mean, I'm with you on both arguments. But and with regard to that very same thing, libertarians do acknowledge the need to protect the commons. And this is the thing that confounds me. And I'll say this, right up front. When I was in my mid-20s, I self-identified as a libertarian. for a while. I was in business. I was doing really well. I was making a lot of money. It sounded appealing to me. Hey, freedom, you know, I pulled myself up by my bootstraps, all this kind of stuff. I had a bumper sticker on my filing cabinet that said freedom works. I think Brown was the candidate that year.
The Army has stolen that from you, man.
Yeah, I think so. actually, he has. And but that, you know, that was the mid-70s. But, you know, then as I got older, I realized, wait a minute, there's a whole lot of inconsistencies here. Libertarians say, yes, there is a commons, and we need, and the commons is like our common nation, and so we need an army to protect that, and we need police to protect private property. And, you know, you and I both agree that is a libertarian position, right?
Generally speaking, unless you're a total anarchist of some sort.
Yeah, but that's the basic role of government in the libertarian world. And the role of government that the founders envisioned was larger than that. I mean, they talk about, you know, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I mean, in the Declaration of Independence, it was the first time the word happiness had ever been in the founding document of any country. And the general welfare is mentioned twice in the Constitution as an explicit, A, reason for the creation of the Constitution, and B, as to the fulfillment of the general welfare as an explicit purpose of government. And so, you know, the notion of America has always been that we define the commons, and the commons is where government's role is, and it doesn't extend beyond the commons. So making computers isn't part of the commons. That's not government's role. Making clothes isn't part of the commons. That's not government's role. But determining the rules of the game of business with regard to international trade, for example, that, because that affects every American, thus the Commerce Clause, things like that, that is part of the commons. And therefore, from 1793 until, recently, shall we say, the last decade or so, we had a trade policy in the United States which built manufacturing. It worked to the benefit of Americans. It worked to the benefit of business. But it would be inconsistent with libertarian philosophy that says there should be no national boundaries when it comes to capital.
I think there's a couple of different things to think about in your response. One is that you will get a lot of agreement from most libertarians, including myself, that government has more of a role just, you know, by inertia, if nothing else, than merely defending the country and adjudicating crime. In our book, Declaration of Independence, which really springs from that pursuit of happiness that you referenced, because I agree with you, it's just sort of a marvelous Enlightenment philosophy that we're all still benefiting from and still trying to pursue. The difference comes in, I mean, so in that book we talk about different ways if we're going to have, which we will, if we're going to have government involvement in K-12 education, well, here's a way to take a libertarian insight and make that better. You and I happen to disagree about that insight, but we take that for granted as the world that we live in right now and will for the foreseeable future.
But Jefferson, who was a great, libertarians are always, all the time quoting Jefferson. His number one achievement of his life, in his opinion, and it's why he had it on his tombstone, rather than being president of the United States, was that he created a state-run college that was free to everybody.
Yeah, it's a hell of a beautiful place, too. He architected the thing as well.
Yeah.
But
libertarians would say, oh, he never should have done that.
No,
it should have just been run
not...
like in the Supreme Court 1815 case of Dartmouth College versus the U.S., where the Supreme Court ruled that, you know, yeah, it's a British corporation, but it's a corporation. And so, you know, the government can't take it over. We were trying to exercise eminent domain over Dartmouth.
I think a lot of times when people talk about libertarianism, they create sort of this Ayn Rand libertarian ogre
objectivist
of their dreams more than what the modal libertarian out there is. I mean, yes, there are libertarians who are more anarchistic, who will argue that the state has no business at all in things like welfare and safety nets. I happen to be one who believes that we should have a safety net, but where I disagree with you here probably is that entitlements are ruining the safety net, that you have to choose between one of the two so that Warren Buffett is not on Medicare, but his secretary is, right?
Well, then I'd suggest that you're politically naive, because the history of programs that are defined as welfare, that are programs for poor people, is that they're very easy to cut. And even supposedly progressive or liberal politicians like Bill Clinton ended welfare as we know it. And, you know, it was fine during a boom time. All the restrictions that Clinton put on welfare, and you can't be on it more than 4 years, I think it is, and you know, you've got to jump through all these hoops, even if you're a single mother with a couple of kids. But now that we're in a, you know, three years into the Bush Great Depression, that's coming back to bite a lot of people in this country. And if you start means testing Social Security and Medicare, they're going to turn into welfare programs. And mark my words, somebody's going to come along and say, oh, yeah, people under 200,000 shouldn't get, you know, who have income over 200,000 shouldn't get Social Security. Let's cut that down to 40,000.
Right.
Let's cut that down to 10,000. And then finally, let's do away with it.
I think that's a very interesting objection and one that I'm going to take into consideration because we're having an upcoming feature story on entitlements versus the welfare state. And it's true that when Social Security was envisioned or you know, later on, actually, after people started living longer, the concept was it will retain its political popularity if we spread it among people who don't need it as much. I mean, that's the idea of making it.
Well, it's a very small number of people, too.
But that is also sinking our finances, and that is the problem.
No, it's not. If you took the cap off Social Security so that everybody making over $106,000 paid on all of their income, the Social Security program would be solvent forever. In fact, it would be showing a massive surplus, larger than the $2.6
trillion
it's got right now.
And you might get even the agreement from someone like me. So there
okay.
you go.
Pat Welch, Reason.com, Reason Magazine, Editor-in-Chief. Thanks, man.
Thank you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, that was interesting. We'll see. Libertarians, definitely not conservatives. I think that the Republicans would beg to differ, but we'll see.
You can go your own way. Go your own way. You can call it another day.
Well, there's a lot of the news, and it's fairly straightforward what's going on. What we're seeing is that big money is triumphing in America. Whether it's the war on workers in Phoenix, Arizona, where Jan Brewer now, after doing her photo op with the president that catapulted her book to number one on you know a lot of bestseller lists and you know made her some bucks. Talk about you know using public office for private gain. She is now taking Scott Walker's war on unions and John Kasich's war on unions and putting them on steroids. There's legislation being introduced into the legislature in Arizona, and I especially call out to our listeners on KPHX in Phoenix, pay attention to this, that not only would ban public unions from deducting union dues, but would ban collective bargaining. And forget about stopping strikes. This is would ban collective bargaining. You have no right to organize yourself together as workers and say, you know, we'd like a safe workplace. And it's also targeting the police and firefighter unions, which Scott Walker at least was smart enough to say, don't get on the bad side of the cops. Let them have their union. But will this be the great overreach in Arizona? I don't know. But this is the kind of stuff that's funded by the right-wingers like the Koch brothers, all this anti-union stuff, because they think that unions are like some kind of communism or something. They're going to destroy America. But if you look at the history of America, the time when we had strong unions was the time when we had the strongest middle class. Now, I realize billionaires didn't have it quite so good. They were paying 74% income tax rate instead of 15%. But, you know, they were okay. Clip number 12, Jacob. This is Warren Buffett had some words on this recently on ABC News.
So if this is a war, I wouldn't call it a war, I'd call it a struggle. But if this is a war, my side has had the nuclear bomb. I mean, we've got K Street and lobbyists, and we've got money on our side in terms of contributions. We've got money on our side in terms of lobbyists. Deb does not have a lobbyist. So if there has been a war going on, the war has been waged by the people that are very well-to-do, super rich in many cases, who are trying to shift more of the burden over to people like Deb and away from themselves. And like I say, we've won.
We won, it says Warren Buffett. You know, not being a billionaire myself, I can't say that. But, you know, this guy's a genuine billionaire. Hey, we got the nuclear bomb. We won. And you saw proof of that in Florida. And as I started the show, you know, I was reading this letter by Thomas Jefferson in 1787 to his old friend Edward Carrington. And he said, experience declares that man is the only animal which devours his own kind. For I can apply no milder term to the general prey of the rich on the poor. So Mitt Romney won last night by 15 points over Newt Gingrich. He ran 13,000 TV ads in Florida. He spent more, Mitt Romney spent more in Florida than John McCain spent in the entire primary election, every single state in the union, just 4 years ago. Now, how is he able to do this? Because nine people in black robes who think that they are the kings of America ruled in January of 2010 in the Citizens United versus FEC ruling in the Supreme Court that corporations are people and money facilitates speech. When, in fact, corporations are not people. They are a legal fiction. They are creatures of the state. We allow them to be created. We give special privileges to people in business, which are associated with the right with being incorporated. Corporations are just legal fictions, number one. And number two, money is not speech. Money is property. If you've got a $100 bill in your hand, is it yelling at you? It's property. Or it's a reflection of property. You can convert it into, dinner or into a, in this town, you can convert it into dinner for one maybe or two. It's amazing. Well, talk about the bubble. Washington, D.C., it's just amazing how expensive it is to live in this city. It blows my mind. Anyhow, in fact, Louise and I are looking back at the water. We lived in this floating home in Portland, Oregon, for 5 years. And what always astounds me is that the floating homes, at least in Oregon, this is not true in Washington, and I think it's because they've cut the number of them. Because in Seattle they're very expensive, but in Portland, the floating homes are like half the cost of waterfront property, if you can get it. They're actually quite cheap. They're startlingly cheap. And Louise and I are looking this afternoon. We're going out to look at a boat. And this would be interesting. We'll cut our rent in half. Seriously. Bob Ney used to do that. He used to live in a houseboat in a marina down here. He was telling us about it. Hey, it's a cheap way to live. It's a nice way to live. You live outdoors. So anyhow, Mitt Romney raked in $30 million from just 200 donors. His super PAC spent just the super PAC. This isn't the campaign. This has no association with the campaign. They legally can't talk to each other. The Billionaires for Romney Super PAC. Now, they took a different name. I'm sure it was originally Billionaires for Romney, or I would guess. But after President Obama gave a speech, and thank you, Jacob Dean, for pointing this out to me. After President Obama gave a speech in which he used the phrase, let's win our future, we need to be winning our future, Romney's Super PAC named itself the Winning Our Future Super PAC. Isn't that sweet? So that Super PAC alone spent $15 million in Florida, and he ran 13,000 ads. Here's the Obama clip.
And we know what it will take for America to win the future.
There you go. Got to win the future. Well, Mitt Romney, snatch that one. Hey, that's a good one. Snatch that. Name our pack after that. Hey, forget about that name, Billionaires for Romney. That didn't poll very well. It didn't sound good. Billionaires for Romney? Come on. Well, it's what it is, of course, but we'll call it Winning the Future.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. You can drop into our live free chat room over at TomHartman.com 24/7, and we'll be back with your calls right now. Occupying the airwaves, Tom Hartman here with you. We had a caller earlier in the program who referenced a riff I did recently on how the UN just came out with a report yesterday saying that world population by 2040 is going to hit 9 billion, and that's going to be a major problem for us humans, not to mention every other species on Earth, and how the most effective way that we can prevent that from happening is worldwide working to empower women, because when women have education and power, population growth slows to zero very, very quickly. And regardless of country, regardless of culture, fill in the blanks, it's not wealth, it's not access to birth control. Those are important things. But it's political power and education. specifically for women. And here's Bishop Tutu saying basically the same thing.
We look for a world that will give women greater equity. We won't make it without the women. We won't make it alone. You can be as rich as you like. You can be as powerful as you like. Ultimately, there is a rot that will undermine it all. And we are seeing it in this turmoil that is happening.
There you go. And that was when he was speaking at Davos a couple of days ago. Steve in Phoenix. Hey, Steve, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. How are you doing today?
Just great, but I'll get better. How about you?
Terrific, terrific. Thank you. You were spot on in your supposition. A few weeks or months ago, you had wondered aloud about people who worked for insurance companies, whether they like their jobs or not. Well, and you supposed they hated it. Well,
yeah.
You were spot on.
Yeah.
I worked for a number of them for 15 years, you know, after we moved to the Valley here.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a grind, and they're understaffed. And no, they don't like it. You were right. And another sad thing, too, is in some of the TPAs that there are, there's, you know, different plans, different mom-and-pop shops have their insurance through a TPA.
What's a TPA?
It's a third-party administrator.
I see. Okay.
Okay. And some of the executives for certain companies and their families, they'll get their claims paid. And then not only beyond that, what happens, they get their co-pays and other expenses paid, reimbursed at 100%, whereas the average layperson just gets the standardized plan. So it's a kind of a two-class system we have here, too.
Is it because there's a separate special kind of plan for them, or is it because they negotiated that as one of their terms of employment?
Well, it was probably negotiated as terms of the contract and things
right.
like that.
Right.
But it still shows the, you know. The
it's
two-class.
A two-class society. This is what we have. We used to have a three-class society. We used to have the poor, the middle class, and the rich. Middle class got pretty big, in fact, during the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s. And then, you know, Reagan declared war on the middle class, and now we're back to a two-class society. We got the rich and the poor. And, you know, it's half of all Americans right now who think they're in the middle class are less than 3 months away from being at the bottom of the level of poverty if they lose their job
paycheck
or have a serious illness. 47%.
Paycheck to paycheck.
Yeah,
and,
absolutely.
And the other sad thing is it's really too bad about California turning down that universal health care. And, you know, where I live here in the retirement community, I've spoken to a number of Canadians, and about 20 of them over the last 3-4 years, and they all love their Canadian health care.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
They laugh.
Oh, you know, Louise and I lived in Vermont for 5 years, for 10 years, in two different mm-hmm. cities for 5 years each, and you know, we're right there on the, you know, we were an hour and a half from the border to, you know, to Montreal, two hour drive to Montreal. We used to go for weekends. And
sure.
I never saw Canadians in Vermont looking for health care. I did, however, every Saturday morning in downtown Montpelier, see the buses line up for senior citizens to get on and drive up to Montpelier, up to Montreal to buy their prescription drugs. Bernie Sanders helped organize that. So,
sure.
You know, the Americans were crossing the border to Canada to get their pills. But I, you know, all these conservatives say, oh, look at all these Canadians coming to America. I'm sorry. I grew up, first 27 years of my life, I lived in Michigan. I lived in Lansing. You know, we were just, you know, again, 100 miles from the Canadian border, from Windsor. Not even, maybe just a little more than maybe 120 miles. And I never saw a Canadian looking for health care. You know, two of my sisters-in-law work in hospitals in Michigan, and I never hear these stories. I mean, it's
sure.
just, it's incredible. Steve, thank you for validating my gut instinct that, you know, the people have jobs because they have to raise a family. You know, I remember when I was living in Atlanta and some particularly egregious, it was when the healthcare executives were testifying, no, tobacco is not addictive. And I just got so PO'd that I picked up the phone and I called RJR, which was headquartered right there in Atlanta. And the poor woman who answered the phone, you know, and she said, you know, RJR and or RJ Reynolds or whatever they called themselves back then.
Sure.
And I said, how can you sleep at night? I just went off on her, right? And she came back and she's in tears. She came back and she said, I've got two kids. I'm a single mother. I'm just trying to put them through school. I'm not the one who makes the decisions here. And I just felt like such a heel. You know, it suddenly hit me. You know, people have to work for a living, right?
And that is true. You know, the people there, they're just doing their jobs.
Yeah.
And, you know, the rank and file person that works for an insurance company, their health insurance isn't any better than anybody else's.
Yeah, I'm sure that's true. Thanks a lot, Steve, for the call.
Thanks, Tom. I appreciate you taking the call.
Sure. Thanks for the enlightenment. I appreciate it. Mike in Youngstown, Ohio. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Every once in a while we start talking about the Supreme Court, and we say if for no other reason to vote for Obama the next time, you know, just so that we can get the liberal Supreme Court justice. If Ruth Bader Ginsburg is in such bad health and so close to retiring, why doesn't she retire now and let him appoint somebody in her place now? At least we know.
That's what Sandra Day O'Connor did, and she did it strategically.
Why doesn't she retire now? Let him appoint, another liberal
progressive
justice in her place.
Yeah.
Yeah, that way we know at least her seat is safe.
I have no inside information on this, Mike, and I don't know her, and I don't know anybody who knows her. And the political class in this town, to the extent that I interact with them, tend not to talk about the Supreme Court other than, gossip about Clarence Thomas. But my guess would be, if I was to go over to Intrade and place a bet on something, I would take a bet of as much as 60 or 70% that Ruth Bader Ginsburg will retire this year and that it'll probably be sometime in the middle of the summer. But who knows?
Yeah, I hear that.
Because that's what Sandra Day O'Connor did. The last year of the Bush administration, she said, okay, that's it. I'm out of here. And then she lived to regret it, by the way, because then, she retired because her husband had Alzheimer's. And she wanted to care for him, but then they put him in a facility, and he started sparking with another woman. And so she's kind of I'm not even sure if he's still alive or not. And that's kind of a tragedy. But what's even more tragic is that she left the Supreme Court to care for him, ended up not being able to care for him for whatever the reasons, the dynamics of our society, fill in the blank. And then Citizens United happened, and she kind of basically came out and said, I wouldn't have decided that way. Had she still been on the court, we wouldn't have had Citizens United. It would have been a 5-4 defeat rather than a 5-4 win. She was a Republican conservative.
Incidentally, speaking about health care, my wife works for a doctor in Atlanta, and he called all of his employees in today. He's canceling their health insurance. He can't afford it anymore.
Yeah.
A doctor.
Yeah, a doctor is canceling the health insurance of his employees. Yeah. Amazing. Thank you, Mike, for this. Thanks for the story. Thanks for listening to XM. Kezia, or is it Kezia? How do you say it in Culver City?
Hi, my name's Kezia from Culver City.
Kezia, hey, how you doing?
I'm good. How are you, Tom?
Great. What's up?
I love your show. I just, first time caller, just wanted to say, when you were talking about the population control and how women, I totally agree with you about how women have to be educated and put in power. But the other thing is, too, as far as population control, the other 49% of the population needs to be educated as well. I don't think that we educate the young boys in high school and men, we really have to get them to cover their packages as well.
Yes, agreed.
Women wouldn't be getting pregnant if the other half wasn't, if they were taking care of themselves. And I feel very passionate about that. So I just wanted to say hello.
Okay. Well, thank you, Kezia. Thank you very much. I appreciate the call. And it's really interesting when you look at, I wrote about this in Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight. When you look at countries, it used to be the prevailing myth was, back when Paul Ehrlich, back in the 70s, when he wrote The Population Bomb, and he said, oh, my God, look at this. We're going to, at that time, we were 4 billion people. We're going to add another 2 billion people by 2000. And it'll be a disaster, and there's going to be widespread famines and wars and all kinds of things. And to some extent, a lot of what he described in the Third World has come true. And everybody figured that there were two solutions to the population problem. One was to make people wealthier, because when you look at rich nations, they tend to have zero population growth. And the other was to make sure that everybody has access to birth control, because it just kind of makes sense. If people have access to birth control, then they'll control pregnancy. Turns out that there are lots and lots of countries, in particular in the Middle East, where wealth is higher than anywhere else in the world, or most countries in the world. There are Middle Eastern countries where the average income is $30,000, $40,000 a year because they just basically pass out oil money, and they still have 12 children in the average family. So it's not money that does it. It's not wealth. And in those same countries, birth control is widely available. Widely available. In some of these countries, it's over the counter. So it's not birth control. It is power. It's political power and education, and the political power that comes from education. And because in those countries, women are not allowed to go to school, and they're not allowed to play in the political realm or in the business realm. And so it turns out that that's the one thing. And Bishop Tutu was right about it, and Keisha was right about it. And this is one of the great issues of our time that everybody is ignoring, is the fact that not just in the United States, but, I mean, this needs to be a worldwide crusade to empower women through education and economic and political power. Tomorrow, today.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Up next, more of your calls. Plus, we're going to check in with the Talk Radio News Service here in Washington, D.C., find out what's going on in the world.
Life's too short to be even care at all. Whoa, whoa, whoa. I'm losing my mind, losing my mind, losing control.
Talk media for the sane among us. It's the Tom Hartman Program. Mark in Reedsboro, Vermont. Hey, Mark, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Just came about your program not too long ago in the Free Speech TV. I think it's fantastic.
Thank you.
You're talking to one of the forgotten few. When I say that, I'm on Social Security disability. I have been since the age of 43. And I know people who bring that up, you know, when people first hear you're on disability, they immediately think that you're a loafer and you're just, you know, working off the system or whatever. And that's a shame, but, you know, there are those that do that, and there are those like myself who need it.
Well, they make it pretty damn hard to get Social Security disability these days. So I think the freeloaders are few and far between.
Yeah, well, I've
and it's
been
a, it's a price I'm willing to pay to have a good system.
Right. Well, I've been on it for the last 9 years, and you know, to hear Romney say that we have the safety net, you know, I drive a 15-year-old vehicle that's rotting out and on its last leg. I got a TV that's broken. It's got to be replaced. I got my computer went down. I got to replace that. I sleep on a bed that's almost older than me. And, you know, the pittance that they give you is a safety net. I mean, I'm not asking to be taken care of and to live a big lifestyle.
Yeah.
You know, it just...
The safety net basically is we will keep you in poverty. Yeah.
You know, I just want to be comfortable. And, you know, Social Security rules, a car is not a necessity.
Hmm.
And I'm 4 hours from my only daughter and my only granddaughter. And she's 2 years old now, my granddaughter. And I've seen her twice.
Yeah.
And,
well, a car is not a necessity if you live like in D.C. Louise and I sold our car before we moved here. But if you live in Vermont, I tell you, having lived in Vermont, you got nothing but cars. That's it.
That's correct.
There's an occasional bus route, but they're few and far between there.
Well, yeah, if I want to take the bus to go food shop and I got to grab it at 7:30 in the morning and wait till it comes back at 5 o'clock.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that doesn't work.
You know, for me to just go pick up one prescription, it's an hour's round trip.
Yeah.
Drive.
Yep. Mark, I appreciate you sharing your story with us, and I think it does highlight the Mitt Romney's being so out of touch. I mean, here's a guy who was born a millionaire.
You know, Washington in general, you know, all they talk about is the middle class, and I understand that, but it really hurts to be, like I said, the forgotten few.
Yeah, okay,
never talked about. Never.
I'm with you. Mark, thank you for the call. I mean, this is the area where, for example, President Obama, here's a guy whose mother was on food stamps. Compare that to Mitt Romney, who was literally born a millionaire, just like George Herbert Walker, or just like both George Bushes were. Rosalind, and speaking of George Bush in Texas, Rosalind in Dallas, you're where George is living now. Hey, Rosalind, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I'm so glad to get a chance to talk to you. You have saved my soul. I've been wanting to hear somebody talk about what you've been talking about. So
well,
I just found your show about 4 months ago.
Oh, great.
Anyway, I'm unemployed. I lost my job taking care of my dad, and I had an interesting situation. I went to the sleep apnea doctor yesterday. They told me that the appointment would be 55, and it actually was $180-something, and I couldn't pay it. And it's funny how when you don't have insurance that you become like a leper.
Mm-hmm.
Or something. And I thought, you know, as a female, it seems that they would make sure that women have coverage. But the other thing I wanted to mention is the money that the super PACs are using to fund the candidates. You know, you hear 20 million, 7 million, you just hear these millions thrown around. And my confusion is, where is all the money? We just closed 11 schools in Dallas in minority areas, and I want to know, okay, they closed down these schools because we have a $20 million deficit, but somebody else is spending $20 million to put somebody in office, and then they'll close down more schools.
The Fortune 400, there are 400 people in the United States, the 400 richest people in the United States. Those 400 people own more wealth than the bottom 150 million Americans, the bottom half of Americans. Just the heirs to the Walton fortune own more wealth than 30% of America. So, you know, yeah, there's a lot of money in America. There's fantastic wealth in America, and it's held by not the 1%, the 10th of 1%. Most of it is held by.
Wow.
Yeah, it is.
Well, now, and one other thing.
Sure.
I took some sociology classes, and I had figured out what Bishop Tutu was saying. Mm-hmm. I had finally figured it out on my own, and I was really excited to hear him say it. And I believe it. We do need a revolution of women, you know, coming out and saying, hey, you screwed up. Let's do it again. Because
yeah.
I don't see how the guys are going to fix it.
Yeah.
But anyway, I'm just really excited to talk to you and to get somebody who understands and knows my views and to hear other people that have the same views too.
Well, thank you, Rosalind. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. And thank you for the call. And thanks for watching Free Speech TV. This is one of the things, you know, from debating conservatives and trying to model how to have a debate with your crazy brother-in-law over Thanksgiving dinner without there being blood on the floor, to highlighting issues so that people really understand them, to talking about the news of the day, to trying to put things in a historical frame that, you know, these are the last night. In fact, Louise and I had a meeting with a couple of people that work with our show and talking about, you know, what's our mission statement? How do we do it? Why do we do it? How do we put this thing together? And that's what we're trying to do. It's really nice to hear the feedback. Thank you very much that we're accomplishing that. And let me take it a step beyond that. Now that becomes your work. So you reach out to friends of yours and say, hey, did you know this? I was while Rosalind was talking, I was trying to grab somewhere around here. I've got a piece of paper with this whole set of statistics about wealth in America that are just quite shocking. I'll have to dig it out and share it with you in the next hour. But it is, you know, these are the kinds of things, and they're not secret. I mean, you can find them, although it's hard to find them in the places that get scrubbed by the right wingers. But these are the kind of things that more Americans need to be knowing, frankly. It's part of economic literacy.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Curtis Dubé is with us. He is the Senior Policy Analyst specializing in tax issues at the Heritage Foundation. Curtis, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you with us. Heritage.org, of course, the website for the Heritage Foundation. Sheldon Whitehouse, the United States Senator, is who's up for re-election in 2012, is proposing a piece of legislation following what President Obama has referred to as the Buffett rule, which is, in theory, that billionaires should not, or even millionaires, anybody who earns over $1 million a year, which is a hell of a lot of money, anybody who earns over $1 million a year should pay at least 30% income taxes on the money after their millionth and $1. And now, if it was actual earned income, they'd be paying 35 or 36%. But, you know, let's pay 30% on capital gains. Ronald Reagan had something to say about this. Jacob, you have that clip? We played it a little earlier. I should have warned Jacob I was going to call for this. This is what Ronald Reagan had to say about millionaires and billionaires being able to have a capital gains tax loophole.
We're going to close the unproductive tax loopholes that have allowed some of the truly wealthy to avoid paying their fair share. They sometimes made it possible for millionaires to pay nothing while a bus driver was paying 10% of his salary, and that's crazy.
And that's crazy. So Reagan actually set the capital gains tax at exactly the same rate as the earned income tax. Why was Reagan wrong?
Well, first of all, I don't quite know what Reagan was referring to there. It's not
1986. He set capital gains at 28%, and he set ordinary income at 28%. That's what he was referring to.
Okay. Well, look, if we know now, I'm not sure what the context of. I think they were trying to get revenue to a certain level back then, and the 86.
The deal was that the Democrats what the Democrats gave up. Was they would allow the Reagan had dropped the top tax rate from 74% to 50% in 1982, and which then produced a terrible recession. And then he wanted to drop it even further because he thought that would be the magic bullet. And so in 86, he said, I want to drop it to 28%. At that time, the capital gains tax rate was, as I recall, around 20%. And so he said to the Democrats, come along with me on this, and I'll raise the capital gains tax to 28%, and we'll have both tax rates be at the same level. And he was able to get enough Democrats to go along that he was able to get that thing passed.
Right. Well, that's ancient history. What we know right now is that the more we tax capital, the stuff that the economy uses to create stuff and to employ people and pay them wages, the less we get of it. So we want to keep the
tax rate
capital as low as possible. I mean, that's basic economics.
No, it's not. If you look at the time during the greatest growth of the United States, we've had in the history of this United States, we've had only one time when there were four consecutive decades where growth, GDP growth for the entire decade was over 3%. And that was the 50s, 60s, 70s, the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s. Those
four decades. And you weren't going to go to the 80s.
Well, no, actually, the 80s had a couple of severe recessions as a consequence of Reagan's changes in policies and his tripling of our national debt, his running up, you know, the original. I mean, Reagan borrowed more money during the 80s than all presidents from George Washington and Jimmy Carter combined. He did a lot of economic damage. But during those decades, those four decades, when we had the strongest economic growth in America, even stronger than during Reconstruction, during the robber barons era, the top tax rate, including the top tax rate on capital, was over 50%. And we didn't have bubbles, and we didn't have bursts, and we didn't have crazy roller coaster rides. And the average, you know, wealthy person was making 30 or 40 times what the average working person was. We had a strong middle class, and now we've got these huge divides in wealth because we're not taxing capital.
Well, the major difference is we did not have a competitive global market like we have today.
Certainly
capital
we did.
Capital can go anywhere around the world at the click of a mouse. And back in those days, the U.S. was basically the only, or at least the most industrialized country in the entire world. Capital didn't have a lot of places to go besides here at that time.
Are you serious?
So quickly around the world.
They were rebuilding Germany. Capital could go to Germany. They were rebuilding Japan. Capital could go to Japan.
Countries were much, much smaller than
the
U.S.
world
was.
In aggregate was much larger than the United States.
Well,
I'm
again,
not buying your argument.
Capital is a lot more mobile than it is. Is a lot more mobile today than it was then, and so we can't afford to be taxing it so heavily. It will continue to search for places where it can earn a higher return, and that's what's happening today.
Capital is not more mobile than it was then. A millionaire or a billionaire, if they wanted to invest in, if they wanted to put their money in a Swiss bank account, it was actually a hell of a lot easier back then than it is now. And you know, moving capital around, it's always been, you know, easy and available for corporations and transnational corporations. It was more expensive to move goods across national borders because we had tariffs, but the tariffs didn't extend to capital; they only extended to goods.
Yeah. So your point is, let's raise taxes on the rich, and so
let's have rich people pay the same tax rate that working people pay. What's wrong with that?
Well,
and you're saying that there's some social benefit from giving rich people a tax rate.
It's based on a flawed premise, right? So Warren Buffett says he pays a lower tax rate than his secretary, which is complete hooey. It's not even close to true. First of all, the Congressional Budget Office says that the top 1% pays an effective tax rate of 30% of all federal taxes. So the Buffett rule, as President Obama defined it in his State of the Union address, is already in place.
Well, they're paying 30% of all federal taxes, but they're earning what, 40, 45% of all federal income?
It's
way over 30%. I guarantee you that.
No, it was I thought it was 20-something percent the last time, but I'm not 100% sure, but it doesn't matter. They're paying much higher tax rates than the middle class. So the Buffett...
Well, you know, if you slice... Warren Buffett's not in the top 1%. He's in the top 0.1%. And if you slice out the top 0.1%, which is really what we should be debating, not the top 1%, you will find that they are not paying those kind of income taxes. In fact, the Fortune 5, you know, Fortune magazine did this math and published it in their magazine. The Fortune 400, their average income tax rate was 14.8%.
Right, again, and that,
the richest people in America.
I'm saying all federal taxes, because you have to include the corporate income tax. Because rich people who earn capital gains dividends.
Oh, that's what. So you're saying that the reason why somebody like Paris Hilton, who earns her living sitting in a bikini around the pool on her butt, waiting for the dividend check to arrive, the reason that she should only pay 15% is because the corporation paid income tax on that money before it was distributed as a dividend. Is that right?
What I'm saying is a second layer of taxation. So the corporation that generates the dividend or the capital gain is paying 35% before she pays a 15% rate.
So when you do the math,
that's like 45%.
Okay, so that now I understand where your numbers are coming from, and that's why Mitt Romney says, even though the IRS says he paid 13.9%, he's saying, well, actually, it was about 40%. So if I earn $1 million a year in revenue and dividends or long-term capital gains from ExxonMobil, which hasn't paid any federal income taxes in years, how is that double taxed? Or from General Electric? Or from any of the other, you know, majority of large corporations in America who are not paying 35% tax?
If they're not earning anything, you're not getting a capital gain or a dividend.
Last year, 2010. In 2010, ExxonMobil earned $28 billion. Their earnings were greater than that. They distributed as dividends $28 billion. General Electric distributed as dividends $29 billion. That is after-tax money, and they paid no federal income tax. How can you possibly call that double taxation?
Remember, it's worldwide income. It's not just the U.S. So if you look at the income they earn in the U.S., it would be lower. And the reason not paying any tax, federal income tax, is because for two reasons. One is they had major losses that they carried forward from the years before, from the financial crisis where they had huge losses through GE Capital. And then, of course, all the green energy credits that the left is so fond of, GE is the biggest benefit.
But the point is they paid no taxes, and you're saying that billionaires, when they take that money, when Paris Hilton gets that money, she shouldn't have to pay more than 15% income tax because it's already been taxed. But it wasn't.
If they're paying dividends and you're getting capital gains, over the long run, you average it out, they will be paying that tax over. You can't look at a one-year snapshot, is what I'm trying to say, when you're looking at corporations.
Okay. Well, we'll leave it at that. I'll let you have the last word. It's all yours, Curtis. People can read about it at heritage.org. Curtis Dubé, a senior policy analyst on tax issues over at the Heritage Foundation. Thank you for coming on and having a rousing discussion with me, Curtis. I appreciate it.
No problem. Anytime.
Good. We'll be back. It's 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So I'm still, I found my sheet of statistics. I will share these with you when we come back. But I'm still confused. Well, I'm not confused at all. We'll get back. Defending America from the weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you, and Bob in Homeworth, Ohio. Excuse me. Hey, Bob, what's up?
Hey, Tom, glad to speak to you. Good show.
Thank you.
My question is, they're discussing these losses on like 15%, you know, on their money that they make in the market.
Yeah.
That they have paid, and they keep complaining, well, we pay taxes. But the point is this. If I make an investment, I buy bonds or buy stock, and I lose, am I not able to deduct that from my taxes?
Yes, you can. Yes.
Now, if they make a risk, if they take a risky play and they put money in the market and they lose, they don't have to pay revenue. They take money out of the fund because they're not paying revenue.
Right.
That's my loss also.
Right. And also they can
benefit from their taxes.
Right. And also they can carry forward those losses into future years. So if they have losses in 2008 or 2009, they can carry forward those losses to 2010. But if you lose your job in 2009 and then you make a whole bunch of money in 2010 with a new job, you're going to pay taxes on every penny of it. So corporations have completely different sets of rules than we do.
Yeah. And they don't want to pay us for their gains, but they take away from our by risk, right?
It's absolutely right, Bob. Absolutely right. Well said. Thank you very much for saying it. Dan in Sterling Heights, Michigan. Hey, Dan, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Two quick comments. One, and I don't mean to be disrespectful, but I can't remember the fellow's name from the Heritage Foundation, but
Curtis.
To his
Curtis
comments, DeBay. Curtis. Capital gains income has nothing to do with the income earned by the corporation that underlies the security that you made that capital gain on.
That's correct. It's typically capital gains incomes are typically made by selling stocks that you have owned for a while.
Right. And so my second point is when he talks about employed capital, Paris Hilton, by virtue of owning stock, in other words, the value of the stock that she has purchased, is not employed capital. Employed capital is when money is spent to buy property or goods that are used to generate income in the business.
Right.
So if you have a
that's venture capital.
It should be right. I mean, if he has a beef, it should be with personal property tax that is paid by companies, which as a really good liberal but also a good business person, I think it's a counterproductive tax to tax the personal property that a company uses to generate profits and really create jobs.
Right. If we're going to do that, let's generalize it all across the economy and have a wealth tax on everybody, like they do
sure,
in the UK.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But
one or the other.
Dead wrong on the tax rates that those folks pay. They're absolutely below. And just the shell game that he plays with talking about, well, I'm talking about all tax paid, is just so infuriating to me that most people can't tell the difference. And I wish I could be live with them one time and with you and just pick them apart.
Well, I had never realized, you know, because I was trying to figure out, for a long time I've been trying to figure out, why are my numbers so different from Rush Limbaugh's? Why are my numbers so different from the Heritage Foundation? And it turns out that when they're talking about the taxes paid by the top 1%, they look at you know, people like, you know, John Paulson or Mitt Romney. Mitt Romney's a good example. You know, he makes $15, $20 million. He pays 13.9%. But the corporation that distributed that money to him might have paid 15 or 20% income tax. And so they actually combine those two numbers because they're both part of federal receipts. And they end up saying the top 1% are paying 30% of total federal receipts in either directly through their own personal tax payments or indirectly through the corporations that distributed the revenue to them. And now I understand where they're coming up with their numbers. I don't agree with that way of doing math, but, you know,
Even in that, Tom, his logic is flawed because what he saw, double taxation only counts with dividends, okay?
Yeah.
Capital gains, as I said, and that was kind of the foundation, capital gains has nothing to do with the earnings. So whether the corporation is taxed or not on their earnings, you can't flow through the taxes they paid as it relates
right.
to taxes that Mitt Romney pays on capital gains, only what he would have gotten in dividends, and I guarantee you that's a very small portion.
Right, and he's actually not making that money on either one. He's doing it on something called carried interest, which is a slick way of that can only be done by these vulture funds, by these private equity funds, and certain Wall Street banksters. It's a slick way of earning income and calling it carried interest, which is a category that, like capital gains, is taxed at only 15%. And it's not a dividend, and it's not interest technically, and it's certainly not capital gains from the sale of stock. And, you know, I can understand having a lower tax rate. I mean, I'm not in favor of it, but I can understand the rationale for saying, okay, we're going to have a lower tax rate for people who hold stock more than a year because we want to invest, you know, we want to encourage long-term investment. Frankly, I think it should work the other way. I think that long-term capital gains should be the same as ordinary income. Short-term capital gains should be higher than that. That would discourage
Great.
People from churning stock and encourage people
Yep.
to invest over the long term. But I can understand that argument. But to say that somebody who earns their interest, they're living from carried interest or from long-term capital gains or from dividends, should only pay 15% because, you know, somehow the rich are going to help us out. I'm sorry, history does not indicate that. History indicates the exact opposite. And it's just, I don't want to have an argument with Curtis in absentia, but thank you very much for the call, Dan. Let me just very quickly, because we just have a few seconds here before the break. There are I found my stats, 53 million Americans without health insurance, 44 million Americans on food stamps. By the way, more Americans applied for and obtained food stamps during the George Bush administration than have during the Obama administration. Now, granted, the Bush administration was 8 years long, the Obama administration four, but a lot of that happened during the last 4 years of the Bush administration when things got really bad during the beginning of the Bush Great Depression. 49 million Americans, and so when what's-his-name calls Obama the food stamp president, well, Bush was actually the food stamp president. 49 million Americans in poverty, one out of five children. Only 58% of Americans have a job. The median wage is only $26,200. Average household debt is $75,000. American families are $7.7 trillion poorer today than they were in 2007, thanks to the Bush Great Depression. More when we come back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Holy cow, a good, bad, and ugly, and a crazy alert, plus your calls, and more of these stats. The top 20% own 80% of all wealth in America, for example, after this. Yep, that's the good, the bad, and the very, very polygonously ugly, brought to you by EdisonFactor.com. A supplement for the brain. The good. 38 of the world's top climatologists. You may remember in our good, bad, and ugly segment yesterday that our very, very ugly went to the Wall Street Journal for publishing a less than scientific global warming denial op-ed written by 16 scientists whose fields were anything but climatology. Well, today a group of 38 of the world's top climatologists wrote a scathing letter to the editor of the Wall Street Journal, chastising the editors for publishing the op-ed and telling them to, quote, check with climate scientists for views on the climate, end quote. The letter went on to state that the op-ed was written by, quote, the climate science equivalent of dentists practicing cardiology, end quote. The letter picked apart the credentials of the 16 deniers as well as the so-called science they used to state that global warming doesn't exist. Congrats to these 38 climatologists for standing up to Rupert Murdoch and his liberal bashing empire. The bad. East Haven, Connecticut. Mayor Joseph Maturo Jr. You may remember Maturo making the news last week for his stunning statement that he would eat a taco when he went home to reach out to the large Latino community in East Haven. Well, Maturo ran his mouth again yesterday. When asked about his choice to appoint a Puerto Rican to a city committee and not an Ecuadorian, which is the larger population in East Haven, Maturo smugly said, I picked a Latino. Did it have to come from a certain section of the country? As if this wasn't enough of a gap. As if this wasn't enough of a gap, Maturo added, is he not dark enough for you? Light enough for you? The blatant racism that Maturo has displayed twice in 2 weeks is intolerable in our society, and especially in elected office. Maybe he and Newt should grab lunch sometime to share ideas. And the very, very ugly House Republicans. It appears the House Republicans are now in the denial of rights business. Yesterday, Republican members of the House Subcommittee on Energy and Environment had Capitol Hill police detained a well-known documentary crew that was trying to film a hearing on fracking, the highly controversial natural gas procurement method. The same members of the committee also denied entrance to an ABC News team that was also trying to film the hearing. One of the journalists detained was Josh Fox, director of the Academy Award-nominated Gasland documentary, which takes a critical stance against the practice of fracking. While Fox did not have formal Capitol Hill credentials, such formalities are rarely ever enforced with highly regarded journalists in Capitol Hill. It would appear that he was detained only because of his strong opposition toward the fracking process. Apparently, House Republicans have forgotten that the Constitution of the United States protects, with its First Amendment, the right of a free press. And that is very, very ugly. Oh, crazy alert. The hits keep coming. Punxsutawney Phil is going to be jealous. Aaron Deneau, a Washington, D.C. resident, is trying to obtain a live groundhog before Thursday, before tomorrow at 8:30 in the morning, so he can host DuPont Circle's first-ever Groundhog Day celebration. So, his celebration would feature Potomac Phil, who he says, according to groundhog mythology, is the long-lost brother of Punxsutawney Phil. Deneau told the Huffington Post that the father of both groundhogs passed on the internal power of weather prediction to both of his sons. Unfortunately, Deneau's search for Potomac Phil is proving to be very hard. Most wild groundhogs are hibernating this time of year, and his efforts to contact wildlife sanctuaries and animal rescue groups have yet to pay off. Nevertheless, Deneau was prepared for this possibility. He has a puppet groundhog and a stuffed dead groundhog ready to go for tomorrow's festivities. Given that a dead groundhog can't see his own shadow, looks like summer's just around the corner. And if you're listening on one of the two radio stations that carry our show in Washington, D.C. live, AM 1480, We Act Radio, or AM 1390, you might want to give them a call and see if you can help them out here in D.C. Oh, my. So much going on. George in Jamestown, North Dakota. Hey, George, what's on your mind today?
Georgia, but here...
Or Georgia, I'm sorry.
That's okay. I'm good with it.
What's up?
Here's what I'm thinking of. Okay, on the double taxation argument, and I've heard this argument before, anybody who earns money from a corporation, any business, if you earn $30,000 from a gas station, that is money that comes out of their income and therefore would have been taxed or would have been expensed. So it's already been double taxed.
Well, it's actually been expensed. You can charge it against taxes. But here's let me make your argument even stronger. Where did the gas station get that money?
I'm guessing from me.
Exactly.
Come from the gas station.
The gas station got the if a gas station is paying a the person pumping the gas $30,000 a year, they got that money from customers coming to the gas station, and those customers got that money from their jobs, and those customers paid what on that money? Taxes. So,
See, that's the entire fallaciousness of the whole double taxation argument.
Exactly.
Because it's consistent. Everything is constantly taxed.
That's correct. And so what we're doing, you know, the way our taxation system is set up is we tax economic activity. And you tax it at the time of the activity, and you tax it based on the type of activity. And we use the tax code to encourage certain types of activity, like if you buy a house, you can deduct the interest payments from your home. So we want to support home ownership and banks. Or we discourage other types of activity. Like, you know, theoretically, there's a huge tax on marijuana, sin taxes, taxes on tobacco. That's a much better example. But we tax at the time of economic activity. So you're right. Their argument of double taxation is absolutely fallacious. And, Georgia, you did a brilliant job of pointing it out. Thank you so much. Roberta in Los Angeles, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Roberta, what's up?
Hi. I just want to share a perspective. I follow things a lot, and I think the national discourse has subtly been shifting. A lot of people still talk about Gingrich said this, or so-and-so said this, or Walker in Wisconsin. We the people really get it, that it's us against money. It is not what the politicians say.
Yeah.
It's almost like when we follow South Carolina and, now Florida. Oh, Adelson this, and so-and-so came in with that. And we're very clear that if you can be 7 or 8 points behind one day, and a big money bomb comes, and 2 days later you're waltzing to victory, and you just happen to have money. It is real clear. What does that say about democracy if you don't even have enough sense to know what works for you and your family? That is, some casino jerk comes in, drops a bunch of money in your neighborhood, you flip-flop and give him what he wants.
You're absolutely right. Roberta, thank you so much for the call, and thank you so much for making that point. And that's why I didn't do horse race reporting on this. Oh, it looks to me like the conservatives who think they're really conservatives, like Newt, and the conservatives who think that they're really liberals, like Rod, that's all nonsense. It's, the simple fact of the matter is that Romney outspent Newt 2-1 in South Carolina. It wasn't enough. So he outspent him 5-1 in Florida. It's a money race. Period. End of discussion. And that's the corruption of politics in the United States. And, of course, the corporate media is not going to talk about that. They're not going to tell you the truth on that. But that is the truth. It's all about the money. It's the tragic truth. And it's a truth that we've got to change with a grassroots citizens movement. Jeff in Rochester, Minnesota. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Yeah, first, let me thank you for being there. And second, let me apologize for my my old brain here.
Okay.
I'm going to ask you a question. Who is that fellow that had that tax or got that contract on not raising taxes from the Tea Party?
Grover Norquist.
Okay, so
he's a multimillionaire lobbyist here in D.C.
If Norquist can get representatives and senators to sign a contract that basically says that the rich get theirs, why not have somebody such as yourself or some other brilliant person write up a contract for representatives to sign that will basically say that they will commit to amending the Constitution to undo the inequality of the
I think it's a great idea, and that's why I suggest that you go to sanders.senate.gov and sign on to Bernie's petition to amend the Constitution. Go to movetoamend.org. There's another one that Jeff Clements has, and I keep forgetting the name of it. People are persons or something. But if you Google Jeff Clements, it'll come up. With regard to having politicians sign a pledge, in my opinion, they did. It's called their oath of office, and the pledge is to the Constitution of the United States. So I would leave it at that, Jeff. But thanks for the idea. It's a good one. Washington, D.C., Robert. Hey, Robert, what's up? Robert, you are on the air in Washington, D.C.? Okay, Robert ain't it there. Renee in Judah, Wisconsin. Hey, Renee, what's up?
Hi. The gentleman that was called in about the boycotting,
mm-hmm.
and you had asked if there, you know.
I kind of shot him down on that, yeah.
Well, there's one of your Christian evangelical right-wing groups that have sub-parties, the Million Moms. They were able to put a good enough boycott in to where TLC actually removed Sister Wives from their lineup. So that was pretty successful.
Okay, so there was an example of a successful boycott, but it was organized by a very large group that had a lot of money. And, you know, the bottom line for boycotts is that if you're withholding your money, and you consider that a vote, then the people with the most money have the most votes. And, you know, it's not that I don't advocate boycotts. I think they're just fine. And as a moral statement, I'm all with boycotts. Just fine. But generally speaking, they're not effective. But I think you did find the exception to the rule. Thank you, Renee, for that. I appreciate it. And we got to hit a break here. It's 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And we're going to check in with Congressman Steve Israel, the co-chair of the Congressional Campaign, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, and find out, you know, what's happening here? You know, what does what happened in Florida tell us about what might happen nationally? It's the money bomb, stupid.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So back with Steve Israel right after this. Stick around. Tom Hartman here.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
And Leonard Cohen has a new album out, in fact. Please, downloaded it last night and haven't had a chance to listen to it yet. We're going to get there. Congressman Steve Israel's on the line with us. He's the chair of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, the DCCC, and also the U.S. Congressman who so ably represents the 2nd District of New York. Congressman Israel, welcome to the program.
Great to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you with us. You've got this strategy, turning the red to blue, the red to blue races. How do you think you're going to pull this thing off when we just saw down in Florida that after Mitt Romney outspent Newt Gingrich 2-1 in South Carolina, and that wasn't enough to beat him, he finally had to outspend him 5-1 in Florida and did beat him, but he had the money to do it. And right. and in fact, he had 200 hedge fund managers give him $30 million. Democrats don't have that many. We don't have that many billionaires on our side. It's
well, you know what? We have something even better than billionaires. We have the middle class and working families. We have grassroots supporters throughout this country. In fact, to the shock and amazement of virtually everyone, we raised more money at the DCCC than our counterparts at the House Republican Campaign Committee last year by $7 million.
But couldn't it be that that's because a lot of that money on the Republican side is now going into PACs and super PACs instead of to the party?
No. Look, these guys, they know how to organize and mobilize and spread their wealth, so to speak. The problem is that they are trying to defend the indefensible. It's hard to raise money from people when you're trying to take away their Medicare.
Yeah.
It's hard to raise money from people when you're telling them that you want to protect tax breaks for big oil companies, even if that means raising taxes for middle class and working families. So the more we establish our priorities between House Democrats who are fighting for the middle class and fighting for working families versus Republicans who are fighting for millionaires and fighting for oil companies, the more we establish those contrasts and our priorities versus their priorities, the better off we do. And the bottom line is this, Tom. We need 25 seats to take the House back. This thing is in play. It is going to be razor close, maybe a few seats south of 25, maybe a few seats north of 25. But there's such buyer's remorse that's setting in towards these extremist Republicans that people are coming back to House Democrats.
Oh, yeah. And a good thing it is. I mean, Nancy Pelosi, when she was Speaker of the House, passed. I mean, we were keeping track. There was several hundred pieces of really good progressive legislation, including things like, you know, just like common sense things like, let's say to corporations that are manufacturing offshore that we're no longer going to subsidize that with tax breaks. And instead we're going to give them, but we will give them a tax break if they bring those jobs back home.
That's right.
And the Republicans filibustered it in the Senate. It's like, I'm pulling my hair out. These people.
Yeah.
Anyway, pardon my...
I feel your frustration. The thing that I love about my job as chairman of DCCC is I get to wake up every morning and figure out how to stop them from doing that and how to effectuate a campaign plan to take the House back.
So what can, you know, outside of the obvious thing of going to a DCCC website and kicking some money in or supporting local Democrats or whatever, what can listeners do? To what extent does movement politics play into this?
It's critical.
I'm a huge advocate of movement politics.
Movement politics, I think, is going to make the difference in this campaign. And look, you started out absolutely correct. We're up against just a handful of billionaires. And we're up against the Koch brothers, and we're up against Karl Rove, and we're up against that nefarious Supreme Court decision that lets these big corporations, oil companies, and insurance companies spend unlimited amounts of money beaming messages into campaigns without any disclosure or attribution. So here's how we even the score. We make sure that we are mobilizing all of our resources. We're making sure that, we find for progressives. I guarantee you, in every state in this country, there is a Democratic candidate for Congress that could use some help. If it's not monetary contributions, it's going to a headquarters and or writing letters to the editor. So if people go to DCCC.org, there's a list of all of our top-tier candidates. And these are progressives, and they're problem solvers. It's a former NASA astronaut who didn't speak English until he was 12 years old, the son of migrant workers. It's the first African-American female police chief in Orlando, Florida, Val Demings. In almost every state, we have these great candidates who need some help. And I hope your listeners will go to DCCC.org for the full list and learn other ways that they could help take this House back for working families in the middle class.
It's great. It's great to hear you talking like that, Congressman Israel, because, one of the hits on the DCCC in the past has been that they've been more anxious to support basically kind of blue dog candidates or I don't want to pull out a caucus, but let's say conservadems than progressives. And I really agree with Harry Truman that people will vote for the real thing.
Right.
Not for the phony. So,
well, I'm very proud of our recruiting class. It's been described as the most diverse class of Democratic House recruits in history. We're very proud of that. And we're not taking any chances. We're going to be aggressive, proactive. We're not taking our foot off the gas. We're going to keep going until we take this House back.
Yeah. Well, good on it. Good on you. And the website, DCCC.org, of course.
Yes, sir.
Congressman Steve Israel, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks. Talk to you soon.
Great talking with you.
Bye.
And just real quickly, I think we got about a minute left. James in Agawam, Massachusetts. Hey, James.
Hey, Tom. How you doing today?
Great.
I had a question. You brought up when you were interviewing that guy about double taxation of the rich, but I'm wondering about double taxation for normal people who have regular incomes.
Sure.
Many years I'd work and I'd overpay my taxes, so I get money back from the government, but what they do is they end up giving it to you in the next fiscal year, which means they tax it again for that year because they give it to you. How come they don't change that law to be a cash reimbursement? Because you've already made the money and paid the taxes.
Right. I don't know, James. You know, I confess, I don't know. The other kind of double taxation is the fact that you pay income taxes on your income, and then you go out and buy things and you pay sales taxes. And billionaires, by and large, don't because they put their money in Swiss bank accounts. James, thanks for the call. Coming up tomorrow, it's Groundhog's Day, so stay tuned. We know exactly what to do on Groundhog's Day. Is that a groundhog? Really? Yeah? Okay. I'll buy that. And don't forget, democracy begins when you get out there and get active. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.